Vermont Viewpoint is a public affairs program produced and funded by WDEV and the Radio Vermont Group. We welcome listener feedback. Email your comments to vtviewpoint@radiovermont.com.
Good morning. This is Vermont Viewpoint on WDEV. I'm Rick Singeri, and here's where we're headed this morning. Put on the party hats. It's Agritourism Month in Vermont. We're going to learn about how big a deal that business is to our farmers. At 10, we check in with national correspondent Bob Ney. Then Derek Brower of 7 Days discusses some concerns outdoor cannabis growers are having ahead of the legal sale of weed. And we finish hearing from a Champlain College student who's doing an internship with a German cybersecurity firm. But let's begin with agritourism this morning. Last year, I spoke with the owner of Liberty Hill Farm in Rochester about how they've diversified by branching into agritourism. Earlier this month, we heard from Tim Lindenmeyer of Farmcraft Vermont Herb Farm in Shelburne. And this week, from Louisa Conrad of the Big Picture Farm in Townsend, both told us how they have been benefiting from agritourism. This morning, we'll get a bigger picture of what this practice means to Vermont. With me is Kristen Broussard, an agricultural development specialist with the Vermont Agency of Agriculture, Food, and Markets. Kristen, welcome to Vermont Viewpoint.
Hi, Rick. Thanks so much for having me.
Hi there. Okay. And also Lisa Chase, the director of UVM's Vermont Tourism Research Center. Lisa, great to have you as well.
Thanks so much. Happy to be here, Rick.
Great. Now, listeners, if you'd like to ask our guests a question about agritourism, you can call us at 802-244-1777, 877-291-TALK, or you can email vtviewpoint@radiovermont.com. Lisa, I'm sure the concept creates a lot of different ideas in people's minds. So how do you describe what agritourism is?
You're absolutely right that the concept does bring a lot of different ideas to mind, and people use the term a lot of different ways. The core of agritourism, the place where people agree, is on-farm experiences and product sales that are deeply connected to agriculture. Where there's disagreement is when it's something happening at a farm that's maybe not so closely connected to agriculture, or something taking place off a farm that could be connected to agriculture, like farmers markets. So Classic examples where there's agreement are on-farm dinners using the product at the farm, overnight farm stays where you're really immersed in the agricultural experience. Those are examples where people agree that's agritourism.
All right. And Kristen, Governor Scott proclaimed August as Agritourism Month here in Vermont. What exactly does that mean?
Yeah, so the governor proclaimed August as Agritourism Month as a way to highlight and celebrate agritourism across our state. So August is a particularly abundant time for agritourism here in Vermont. It's our peak harvest season and one of the most popular months for tourists to come and visit. And it's also when our Vermont Open Farm Week happens, and it's also Farmers Market Week this month as well. And this year, at the end of August, we actually have the unique opportunity of welcoming people from around the world to the International Workshop on Agritourism. This conference takes place every other year in a different part of the world. So it's a really unique opportunity for both our state and our whole country to host this really special event.
Kristen, last week was that Open Farm Week. We spoke with people about that. Any farms that you got during the week to enjoy it?
I actually wasn't able to make it this year, but in the past, I've gone blueberry picking,
nice.
Done some pick-your-own opportunities, and honestly, it's such a wonderful thing. I remember last time I went, I was not having a good day, mm-hmm. but showing up and spending time out in the fields picking blueberries and, you know, really enjoying that time outside really lifted my mood. So
yeah.
I love that we have so many opportunities to do that throughout the state.
Point well taken. Lisa, how long have Vermonters been practicing agritourism in some form or another?
I'm going to say that the practice of visiting farms, spending time on farms, really has been around since the start of agriculture. harvesting festivals, planting celebrations, barn raising, gathering for maple sugaring, sugar on snow. Those are traditions that Vermonters have grown up with for generations and generations. The term agritourism, you know, sort of marketing it and defining it and commercializing it, that term agritourism comes from the Italian concept of agriturismo, which started in the 1980s when Italians looked at their rural countrysides that were being abandoned as people moved to the cities, and the government in Italy developed incentives for people to maintain the farm buildings and the working landscapes in Italy. Many countries, like the U.S., looked at Italy and said, hey, that's a good idea. We ought to start doing something like that here in Vermont. And some of the, you mentioned Beth Kennett from Liberty Hill Farm, who was on your show recently.
Yeah.
She started taking guests, skiers, onto her farm, you know, back in the 70s and 80s, but wasn't calling it agritourism and didn't realize how thrilled they would be to visit her dairy barn and have the opportunity to milk the cows. So it was really around the 80s, 90s that the term agritourism started to be used here in Vermont, and people like Beth said, oh, wait a minute, I'm already doing this, but, you know, there's more to it than I realized. People are willing, people are excited to come to Vermont for these farm experiences.
Yeah, it wasn't agritourism. It was paying the bills, wasn't it, Lisa? Kristen, then when did kind of this new wave of agritourism really come into vogue here in Vermont?
I'm going to pass that question off to Lisa.
Okay.
She has a better understanding of kind of the history in Vermont in particular.
So entrepreneurial farmers like Beth have been involving visitors on their property. You cut Christmas trees, you know, sugar on snow, maple open house weekend. All these experiences have been happening for decades, but farmers are the ultimate entrepreneurs, super creative, super innovative, super adaptable. They've always been that way. And in recent decades, we've seen all sorts of new ideas, ballet on the farm, certainly different types of tastings and farm-to-table dinners have taken off. So what used to be, thought of more as corn mazes and maybe milking a cow, now there's a whole huge diversity of experiences, goat yoga, all sorts of things that people are going to farms for these days. And the creativity and new ideas are just exploding in Vermont and in other places as well.
Well, Kristen, what are some more creative examples of agritourism that we're seeing here in Vermont on our farms?
So Lisa mentioned farm stays, which are a really exciting aspect of agritourism that's happening throughout the state. So those can involve, you know, having Airbnbs or, hip campsites on a farm. And, you know, people can be really off on their own for those, or they can come in and really have an authentic farm experience while they're there. We know there's a big wedding industry in Vermont as well. People love coming to Vermont to get married on our farms because they're so beautiful and it's such a wonderful, unique setting. I'm really excited about the learning opportunities that farmers are offering on their farms, because I think connecting with the land and with agriculture is just so important. Farmers are doing things, especially like Open Farm Week, hosting garlic braiding workshops or crown making workshops or canning workshops, learning how to use herbs in different formats. So I'm really excited about kind of the different learning opportunities that are available throughout Vermont.
I love the examples. Each time you say one, it's like, oh, yeah, right, that's agritourism. I see that. Lisa, how important is agritourism to Vermont and to other places?
Agritourism has been growing in economic importance for many decades now, but it's also very important culturally and environmentally. Economically, I'll mention that a recent industry study came out estimating the global agritourism market size as over $9 billion, and growth is projected at 12% per year. So we're looking at a global agritourism market size in 5 years of over $18 billion. And, you know, here in Vermont, we, our farms bring in around $52 million annually in direct sales and agritourism and experiences on farms.
I'd say that's a pretty substantial number. And, you know, Lisa, we've talked and heard so much about farmers being encouraged to diversify. So is agritourism another way that Vermonters, Vermont farms can diversify, create value-added markets for their farms?
Agritourism definitely is a way to diversify for many farms, but I am going to throw out the caveat. It's okay. Not for everyone. You know, there certainly are people who go into farming because they, you know, want to produce food. They like growing. They like raising animals. And dealing with visitors is not always something that, you know, all farmers want to do. And sometimes the property may not be set up and ready for visitors. But for those farms that are excited about welcoming visitors onto their property, it is a huge benefit economically for the farm, but also for the visitors, because today only in the U.S., less than 2% of people actually work on farms. So much of the U.S. is really disconnected, not just the U.S., around the globe.
Sure.
So many people are so disconnected from understanding where their food and fiber comes from. And this is an important piece of educating the non-farming public and also providing as a community space for neighbors and rural places.
Kristen, the most rural communities of this most rural state struggle to find ways to remain financially viable, despite the fact that this is, you know, precisely these areas that make Vermont what it is and desirable to people to come visit, right? So how can agritourism help these communities, these rural communities specifically?
You're absolutely right, Rick. Rural communities really make Vermont what it is. So like Lisa said, it is really helpful for diversifying income streams for farmers. But when they do that, it also draws visitors to these more rural parts of the state where they end up staying at inns, they eat at restaurants, they shop at retail outlets. So it's really an important economic driver for rural communities. But in addition to that, it also draws local communities together. You know, in Vermont, we don't think of agritourism as something special. It's kind of just who we are. You know, we shop at farmers markets, we purchase CSAs. You know, like me, we go down the road and pick our own blueberries each summer at our neighbor's farm. But these experiences, which we're lucky to have more access to than many other places, really bring people together in unique and lasting ways. And this builds and strengthens community resilience, because when neighbors know each other, they help each other and they care for one another.
It's funny. We just think of it as, well, that's what you do, right? You've got the blueberry farm down the road. You can go pick your own. And I think to visitors to Vermont, it's like this quaint old way of doing things, but we still find it quite modern. Kristen, why, and I'll ask you this too, Lisa, but Kristen, why is agritourism important to the visitors to Vermont, not just the farms, but to the visitors?
So I love everything about agritourism and the many benefits that I have, but I have to say that the experience and the impact on visitors is what really drives my passion for the subject. People are becoming increasingly aware of the health and environmental impacts of large-scale agriculture, and they're more interested than ever before, like Lisa said, in knowing where their food comes from and how it's produced. Vermont is known for our small farms, our local food, our bucolic scenery, and people are coming here to connect back to that. A survey of visitors in 2014 actually found that 35% visited farms or farmers markets while they were here, and 50% intended to buy Vermont products. And then another 39% said that they were participating in food or drink experiences here, which we like to call culinary tourism, agritourism's sister. We have a really big opportunity here to draw people to Vermont because there are 49 metro areas and nearly 50 million people within a 330-mile radius from Vermont. So this is about, you know, a day or a weekend trip, a six-hour drive.
Yeah.
Lisa, and there's millions of people.
Go ahead.
Oh, sorry. Go ahead.
No, keep going, Kristen.
There are millions of people in this region who are really craving authentic experiences in nature, and Vermont is one of the top destinations to do that. And long term, this might be a bold statement, but I'm going to go ahead and say it. I personally can't imagine something that could have a more profound impact on climate change and the future of our planet. People are scared and overwhelmed by climate change. I know for me, sometimes that makes me want to shut down and do nothing. But when we reconnect with nature and our food, we develop a personal relationship with the earth and a sense of deep responsibility to care for it. I think people need to learn to love the earth before we ask them to save it. And agritourism is the thing that can connect us back to our food and to the land.
That's pretty comprehensive, Kristen. Lisa, anything to add to that?
That was Kristen, you totally nailed it. And like adding to that, the piece about building community, I'll just add on a very personal, individual level. So agritourism, you know, good physically, you're outside, fresh air, being active, and you have access to fresh, healthy product raised on farms. But there is also a lot of new research looking at the emotional and mental benefits of spending time in nature, you know, Nature RX, for example. Well, agritourism, especially, you know, gardening, being around animals, all of that really plays into the mental and emotional benefits that people can experience from visiting farms. So it's not just good for your body. It's good for our souls and our spirits as well.
All right, let's head to one of our wonderful towns here in Vermont, Hyde Park, and talk to Judy. Hi, Judy. Go right ahead.
Good morning.
Good morning.
This is such an exciting topic for me because I and my family, my husband and actually our entire family, including our mothers and kids, and started agritourism in the 1990s, so it was quite a while ago, and on Apple Cheek Farm in Hyde Park. And for all the above reasons, and we opened the farm with sleigh rides, wagon rides, llama treks, had the schools come, local schools, a lot of them did bus tours, and we opened a conference hall, and our son is a cook, and he ran his catering business from our farm. So anyway, have a lot of experience with agritourism, and thank you so much for being there and bringing this topic up today.
Hey, Judy, so what type of farm has Apple Cheek Farm been, you know, before you really kind of went into agritourism?
Yeah, that's a good question, Rick. Thanks for the question. Yeah, we were a dairy for years and had a small maple sugar operation, and we transitioned to organic in 2000. So we were busy over the years.
Oh my gosh.
I would say another, and you may have brought this up, you know, who can do agritourism?
Yeah.
Luckily, my family loved people, and we really enjoyed bringing people to the farm. And I think you need to be there to do that kind of thing. And it's not for everybody.
Yeah, that is a point Lisa made, and it's an excellent point. I'm glad you furthered that, Judy. And when people come from away, from out of state and from out of the country and come to Apple Cheek Farm, what's the reaction? What do you get from those city folk, and I'm a city boy, when they come out and see what happens on a farm?
Yeah, it's varied, but again, as these women have been saying, so much appreciation for the land and how things are grown and the work that you do on a farm. And, Yeah, we did have people from all over the world come to the farm, and all kinds of states, different states, too. Yeah, so much appreciation. And, yeah, and learning things that they just had no idea about.
And what have you learned from them, Judy?
Yeah, that I think, again, that we need a community in a world that is better educated in agriculture. Yeah.
That's great. So what's offered there now? What could people come and do at Apple Cheek Farm? Let us know.
We're retired.
Oh!
So if you want to buy seeds, High Mowing Seeds has our farm now.
Oh, no kidding.
Yeah, we've been retired for a while.
Oh, so. Good for you.
Yeah.
Oh, that's great. Hey, thanks for the wonderful call, Judy. It's great to talk to
you.
Yeah,
thank you for having this topic.
Oh, absolutely. All right. Lisa and Kristen, we're going to pick that up after the break. We're going to go to CBS News and then return to continue our discussion on agritourism. Listeners to ask a question or, like Judy, maybe share how your farm has benefited. You can give us a call, 802-244-1777, 877-291-TALK, or email vtviewpoint@radiovermont.com. And coming up this morning at 11, we've got Common Sense Radio with Bill Sayre. That's followed by the Midday News Service with Lee Cattell and Brady Farkas. This is Vermont Viewpoint on WDEV.
Did you know that Radio Vermont Group Digital Services can create videos including drone footage? We've even won awards for our videos. If you'd like to learn more and see examples of our work, go to rvgdigital.com. Radio Vermont Group, we're more than just radio.
Welcome back to Vermont Viewpoint. I'm Rick Singeri. We are down on the farm this morning, well, on many of them. It's Agritourism Month in Vermont. And Lisa Chase of the Vermont Tourism Research Center, Kristen Broussard of the Agency of Agriculture, Food, and Markets are with me to share insights into what agritourism actually looks like on our farms, what it means to Vermont's economy. And listeners, if you'd like to ask Kristen and Lisa about agritourism in Vermont, you can call us at 802-244-1777, 877-291-8255. Kristen, before the break, we heard from Judy at Apple Cheek Farm in Hyde Park, and I'm sure you were probably just bubbling to hear, you know, a farm that came up, you know, in the 90s with ideas how to diversify, how to get into agritourism, and what that meant to them. What was your reaction to what you heard from Judy?
I really love to hear from farmers who have been doing this for a long time because, like we talked about earlier in the show, you know, it's really gotten a lot more energy behind it in the last decade or so. So yeah, hearing the variety of different things that Judy did on her farm, you know, with the sleigh rides and all of that, it was really exciting to hear from her. I'm grateful that she called in to share her experience.
Yeah, that was great. Lisa, tell us about the work of the Vermont Tourism Research Center.
So here at UVM, I'm with UVM Extension and the Vermont Tourism Research Center, and we do research and outreach. So we do surveys of farmers. Sorry to everyone we've sent a survey to. You're going to get even more from us in the future. But it's the best way that we can get information from a whole bunch of producers and consumers as well and really understand what's working and what's not and what are the challenges. So we do research, but being with Extension, we're always looking to apply that research and learn and provide tools and trainings for producers so that they can do a better job of developing agritourism plans and direct sales marketing plans that work for their farms.
And, you know, you collect those surveys. So how big is agritourism in Vermont, Lisa, in terms of how many farms are involved, how many people it attracts to the state?
Yeah, so one of the best sources of data, actually, that we consistently get every 5 years is the USDA Census of Ag. Mm-hmm. And the last census was in 2017. So a lot has changed since then. But according to that census, there were over 1,800 farms that sold direct to consumers, not necessarily on their farms, but sold direct one way or another, and 186 farms that had experiences on their farms. We estimate there's probably around 500 farms in Vermont that are currently open to visitors for on-farm experiences and product sales.
Mm-hmm. And you mentioned earlier a figure, $52 million that is being spent, being brought into the state on agritourism. But when you give that figure, does that really give the overall economic impact? Usually, isn't there a multiplier that says $52 million spent, but this means $100 or $150 million to the state of Vermont?
You're exactly right that the $52 million figure I gave you, that's from the USDA Census of Ag. So it is income that comes to farms through direct sales and experiences. And it most certainly is an undercount because it actually only includes food in there. It doesn't include Christmas tree cutting and, you know, sort of non-edible products. And I won't go on now about all of my complaints about the way that
you're... All right, that's another show, Lisa.
...collect data. But, yes, that's just direct sales. And, you know, depending, some people would add a multiplier of 3 to 4 times when you take in the indirect and induced effects of tourism.
All right, let's drive down Route 2 east to Plainfield, and we've got Michelle. Hi, Michelle. Go right ahead.
Hi. I wanted to add a historical note. My immigrant grandmother, can you hear the radio?
You're fine.
Grandmother would take her 6 children. They were in the Lower East Side of New York. She would take her 6 children to Colchester to a farm every summer.
Wow.
And it was called a cookalane, which means cook alone. And it was a dairy farm, I think, with other products also. And, but she had her own cooking space, but then they had the run of the farm. The kids had the run of the farm for the summer. So just another example of the hardiness of farmers. That was Colchester, Connecticut.
Okay. And Michelle, when would that be happening?
So that was in the 30s.
In the 30s. Oh, fantastic. Thanks for that.
Okay.
You know, when you go to the Vermont Historical Society's museum there in Montpelier, I can remember seeing ads from the state of Vermont in magazines that were inviting people here in the 1890s and the early 1900s to come up and visit our farms. You know, it was even then it was that kind of draw to get people from the city to come and see Vermont and what we had. Kristen, what is the state doing to support farmers interested in pursuing agritourism?
That's a really great question. So we know agritourism is vitally important to our state and our farmers. So we're really doing what we can to support it. As we've talked about, we've seen a huge increase in income from agritourism, you know, within the last 5 years of the ag census. But this also coincides with a rapid loss of our dairy farms due to industry consolidation and many other factors. We currently have 570 dairy farms in Vermont, and we've lost over 80 farms in just 2020 and 2021. So there's a real need, again, to give farmers different options for income streams. So at the Agency of Agriculture, we're focused on helping to expand the market for agritourism, supporting marketing strategies for farmers, and we also work with the Department of Tourism to invite visitors to the state for authentic agricultural experiences. We work with LISA and Vermont Fresh Network and many other partners to put on Open Farm Week, and we're getting ready to launch the 3rd annual Maple 100 in September.
Oh, yeah.
Which I'm happy to talk more about if you're interested.
Oh, please do. I love that subject.
Yeah, sure. So I'm really excited about this. I've been working on this for a few months, but it's a month-long annual promotion highlighting the many ways to enjoy Vermont maple. So the goal of the campaign is really to take advantage of Vermont's peak tourism season to share with consumers the many ways to enjoy maple beyond just on their pancakes, right? Because that's what most people think of maple as, a breakfast food. So we have sugar makers, farms, and other businesses across the state who are inviting visitors on site to come and explore fun and unique ways to use maple. So we have a bunch of places offering maple creamies, of course, maple beer trail, maple cocktails, cider, dishes with maple, but folks are also hosting foliage hikes and trails through their sugar bushes, highlighting baked goods that use maple as a sweetener. So we're getting excited and really putting a lot of effort into promoting this campaign to kind of the regional metro markets and encouraging folks to come here and try maple during that time.
Oh, you're killing me, Kristen. A couple months ago, I did a live remote from Billtown, from Williamstown, and had the folks from Graham Maple come on, and Graham Farms, and they are doing things like maple cashews, of course, the maple cream, which I now put, you know, a little butter on a toasted English muffin and then that maple cream and forget about it. It's probably the best treat anyone has ever had. What else do they do? Oh, they're maple cream filled donuts. So it's like maple, the maple 100. You can make it maple 1000. There are so many ideas of what to do. Lisa, there's a big difference between running a farm and then operating a farm that welcomes guests onto the grounds. We heard this from Judy a little earlier. What are some of the changes and considerations that farmers thinking about agritourism have to address to be part of this market?
You're absolutely right that agritourism takes very different skills from producing food. You know, now you're thinking about marketing and customer service and hospitality, liability issues of bringing visitors onto your farm and making sure your farm is safe and structured in a way for visitors. So as we discussed earlier, it's not for all farms, but there are many farms that enjoy that kind. As Judy mentioned, it's important to enjoy being with people and sharing your agricultural products and heritage with people. So it's a great way to diversify. If you've got family members or friends or neighbors or employees who are interested in doing things other than production, agritourism is a great way to bring in those skills and areas of expertise.
And Kristen, since this is outside of a farm's wheelhouse, at least initially, how willing are farmers here in Vermont to take that chance on this new opportunity?
Many of the farmers I talk to are really excited about the opportunity to incorporate these different aspects of agritourism, but many are also understandably a little bit nervous about it. So, you know, the state has done a few different things to try and make getting into agritourism easier. We recently passed two pieces of legislation that are meant to support agritourism businesses. The first is Act 41, which beginning in 143, which beginning in 2018, created a statewide land use review category called accessory on-farm businesses. So this states that municipalities and zoning regulations can't prohibit businesses in the same location as a farm. So this allows business owners who currently meet the definition of a farm to do some value-added processing of their products on their property or to host farm tours, workshops, and other agritourism activities. And then in 2021, Act 31 began, which, you know, acknowledges that there's going to be those inherent risks involved in, you know, in agritourism and visiting a farm. So it's just those risks to consumers as long as they're properly warned. So the act covers many of the agritourism activities we've been talking about. And what farms need to do to be covered by that is to post specific wording on a sign at their farm. And that detailed wording can easily be found online.
Now, Lisa, Agritourism Month here in Vermont leads us right up to September 1st, the International Workshop on Agritourism in Burlington. Tell us what is happening at this event. Who's invited to attend? Who's encouraged to attend?
So this is a three-day conference. So it actually goes from Tuesday, August 30th through Thursday, September 1st. And there are actually pre- and post-conference farm tours a few days before and after the conference. So we're extending it for a whole week. And we are bringing together farmers and ranchers and other vineyard owners, other kinds of producers, along with agency folks like Kristen, nonprofits, researchers, extension like myself, any tourism professionals, anyone who works in agritourism in some way from anywhere in the world is invited to come to Vermont. And we currently have over 400 people registered representing 50 different countries.
And how do people register, Lisa?
Our conference website is agritourismworkshop.com. So if you go to that website, you've got all the information about what's happening at the conference and how to register. And I will say we really have a priority of bringing Vermonters and especially Vermont producers to this conference. So we have scholarships available, and we have a limited amount of funding still available. So if we have Vermonters who are thinking about coming, I encourage you to register quickly and feel free to apply for a scholarship, because we're filling up, but we want to prioritize our Vermont entrepreneurs and especially producers.
Mm. Again, that's agritourismworkshop.com. Kristen, for those of us living in the state, I think it's really important to know what agritourism opportunities exist here to either take part in, like you do with the blueberry picking, or to let our visitors know about when they come to see us. So where can people learn about what's available?
Yeah, so I'd say the best place to find agritourism and culinary activities in Vermont is at diginvermont.com. This is a site hosted by the Vermont Fresh Network with support from the Agency of Ag and many other partners. And it's basically an online portal and event guide that helps you find those authentic food and farm experiences across our state. So there's farm events and tasting trails and listings of where you can go pick your own blueberries, and workshops, that sort of thing. But for Vermonters in particular, I really like to point folks to the directory on NOFA Vermont's website. So that's the Northeast Organic Farming Association of Vermont. So they have this awesome map and directory where you can search for farms offering exactly what you're looking for throughout the state. You can search by location, the different products they offer, their certifications such as organic, and whether they offer CSAs or farm stands, et cetera.
All right. Again, a couple that Kristen just mentioned, diginvermont.com, NOFA.org, NOFAVT.org are websites where you can go to. Lisa, for farmers who are interested in incorporating agritourism on their farm, where can they find resources?
UVM Extension hosts a website that's been put together by the Vermont Agritourism Collaborative, which is a partnership of many of the organizations that Kristen's already mentioned, including Shelburne Farms, Vermont, the Farm-Based Education Network. Several partners have come together to create this website, which is at uvm.edu/VT Agritourism. And that has a whole repository of tools and resources, as well as a guide to navigating Vermont's agritourism regulations. So if you're interested in learning more about Act 31 and 143 and some of the zoning regulations that Kristen was referring to, it's all there on this website.
And Lisa, you know, we mentioned the number of farms that are involved, what it's bringing into Vermont right now. But what kind of upside or growth is Vermont hoping will occur in the future here in agritourism here in the state?
We anticipate continued interest from farms that are interested in diversifying. As Kristen mentioned, some farm sectors like dairy are, you know, definitely having some issues and seeing a consolidation of farms. So where we're seeing growth are on these small and medium-sized diversified farms that are interested in connecting with their communities through local sales and experiences on farms. And the Agency of Ag and Extension and other partners are ready and able to help farms that are interested in even just exploring agritourism and maybe dipping their toe in the water, helping them understand what the possibilities are and seeing whether agritourism might make sense for them.
All right. In the last few minutes, we've thrown out a lot of websites, so I'm going to do a little recap. First of all, for the International Workshop on Agritourism, if you're interested in going, agritourismworkshop.com is where you can find information on that. To get out and to experience agritourism, diginvermont.com and nofavt.org. And if you are a farmer interested in learning more about agritourism, uvm.edu/vtagritourism. How'd I do?
You got it. I would also just add, if folks are interested in learning more about Maple 100, either to go to those events or if farmers or producers are interested in joining, they can head to vtmaple100.com.
Excellent. vtmaple100.com. Kristen Broussard is an agricultural development specialist with the Vermont Agency of Agriculture, Food, and Markets. And Lisa Chase is the director of UVM's Vermont Tourism Research Center. Lisa, Kristen, thank you for this wonderful hour. It's been great having you on the show this morning.
Thank you so much for having us, Rick.
You're welcome. A break for CBS News, and we're going to catch up with what's been happening in the world from national correspondent Bob Ney. And coming up today at 1 o'clock, we've got three big, massive attack hours of The Getaway with Dan Cardozo sailing the ship this week for Greg Hooker. This is Vermont Viewpoint on WDEV.
We hope you're enjoying this podcast of Vermont Viewpoint with Rick Singeri. You can find podcasts of some of the other programs on our website. In addition, we also have CBS podcasts, including Sunday Morning with Jane Pauley and 60 Minutes. For a full listing of podcasts, visit our website at wdevradio.com.
This is Vermont Viewpoint on WDEV, and now it's time to check in with national correspondent Bob Ney. Bob, welcome back to your correct time and day slot. It's great to have you back on Vermont Viewpoint.
Thank you. Whatever you choose is correct. How's that?
Wow, you are a politician, even still today.
Oh, yeah.
Well done.
I lasted 24 years.
You know, Peter Welch has a great way of even like the – I'm going to say the most difficult or the worst questions that come from either journalists or, constituents. He always makes it sound like it's the best question he's ever been asked. So, that's a great skill. Let's talk about Mar-a-Lago and the affidavit. So, how much can be learned, by what will be released?
Well, a ton. Now, I do want to mention, Rick, with the affidavits, because having been through a case myself with the Jack Abramoff scandal, it makes me very curious. I would love to see the affidavits on our case. I would love to.
Oh,
they're not going to show them to us. Now, we're going to see partial, from the way I'm reading the judge's statement, we're going to see partial disclosure on these affidavits if the judge rules that way. I find, Rick, this very unusual. My gut tells me, my judge that we went before, or this judge that, you know, the Justice Department's going before, is going to normally say, no, there's a criminal investigation, the affidavits aren't going to be released. But the judge now is telling the department, who doesn't want to do this, take this material, I may have you redact some of it, and some of it we will release. Now, I do want to mention the judge has read the affidavit.
Right.
So So I'm wondering what the judge thinks they've seen that's in this affidavit that they may want it partially released. This is basically very, very unusual.
How much would be, if we got it unredacted, if we were able to read, you know, the normal human being here in Vermont and the U.S. has no idea what's contained in a normal affidavit, you know, to get this information. So what kind of stuff would be in there? How detailed does it have to be to justify going into the home of the ex-president of the United States and to remove files?
Well, let me throw this out here as a hypothetical example.
Okay.
John Smith is the former deputy director of the NSA, National Security Agency, all right? John Smith. That's not who was the deputy. And in this affidavit it's released, and it says, John Smith says that Donald Trump has access to some information the NSA deems as, you know, super secret classified. And the Trump people see this, and they say, John Smith. Well, John Smith was fired. John Smith did this. John Smith had a sexual harassment case. So you can follow where I'm going with
yeah.
this.
Gotcha.
Yeah, because in a normal course of a trial, if I had went to trial, for example, some of my staffers and other people would have been called to testify.
Right.
And my lawyers would have said to me, give me everything bad you know about these people. That's what happens. Oh, right. Same case as this. So instead of going to a trial and these witnesses would come out, these are affidavits if they're released, and you can bet that there's going to be a whole explosion. I don't think the judge is going to release, you know, at random all of it, but it's there's an indication there already that the government's going to have to release something, and the Justice Department wants no part at all, period, of a release.
And so the judge has ruled the DOJ now has to, what, go through and request what they would like to have redacted, and when would we see this affidavit?
I think they have – I could be wrong. I think they have a week or so. Maybe they'll get an extension of time to go through this. They would have to, you know, redact what they want. Now, obviously, it's going to be between them and the judge because the judge knows what's in there. In general – and this is one of the problems they'll have anyway. Let me give you another hypothetical because we don't know what we're dealing with. But let's say that the government says, oh, the information we got out of Trump's house, there was 5 super secret documents. And then the press says, well, what was in those documents? They were so super secret. And the government says, well, in the interest of national security, we can't tell you. It's not going to work in this case. It's a former president of the United States. Somebody has to look at that. And somebody has to say, wait a minute. And that somebody in this case is the judge. So if the government comes back and says, out of 19 lines, we're redacting, you know, 16 lines, the judge may say, well, wait a minute. You know, what's wrong with the other 5 lines? Why can't you redact 5 more? That's what will, I think, happen, a back and forth between the government and the judge.
All right, let's move on to Georgia. Rudy Giuliani called to testify there. First of all, why... Rudy, why was he called to Georgia?
Well, Rudy Giuliani has been the main, you know, spoke in the entire wheel. And Rudy Giuliani throughout the entire, you know, the election was stolen process. Rick, if you watch the press conferences, he would mention things that, well, we had this information brought to us about, you know, 58 fake ballots or 1,000 fake ballots or whatever. Well, then when they went into the court processes, there were over 60 some official legal filings all over the country. When they went into the court processes, sometimes Rudy Giuliani didn't file that with the court. He would say it at a press conference and not file it with the court. Now, in this case, they're not going to go after him for that type of action. That's a question of the Bar Association, you know, if for him.
Yep.
They're going to go after him, I think, specifically for what was his interaction on Georgia. What did he advise people to do? Did he make statements, for example, to people that, you know, hey, you know, we can take care of you, or, you know, we'll be very angry if you don't help us. Statements to people in Georgia. I think those are the types of things they're looking for. Mm. He did 6 hours before a grand jury. I do want to throw this out here because, you know, I know how the government process works personally. And I will tell you that at some point in time after 6 hours, if they think they've got something on Rudy Giuliani with Georgia, then what they're probably going to do with him is say, which they normally do, you know, we're looking at charging you with 45 indictments. You know, what do you know about the president? That's a bigger fish to fry, the former president.
Right.
That's a bigger fish to fry. And those types of things could again, this is hypothetical,
sure.
I wasn't in the room. But
absolutely.
These are very realistic things that could happen. And I'm talking because I know it happened in Jack Abramoff in my case.
Mm-hmm. Another thing that I think you're interested in is this college student poll. The poll, what did the poll ask and find? I found this really pretty intriguing.
I'm a 68-year-old, almost hippie, okay?
Right, right.
You know, if you look back, I was in college in 1970, you know, three and four. Anyway, in those days, you know, people had divergence of opinion, et cetera, et cetera. And you would have your groups and arguments. Well, in this one, though, this goes a little bit beyond the way we functioned, I guess.
Yeah.
But 46% of the young people said they would probably or definitely not room with someone who supported the opposing presidential candidate in 2020. And 53% said they would probably or definitely not go on a date with someone who supported the other side in 2020. And 63% said they would probably or not definitely not marry someone who supported the other candidate. So 73% of the Democrat voters polled from the class of 2025 said President Biden, by the way, shouldn't run again. 27% said he should. And then 57% of Republicans polled said Trump should run again. So you've got the Trump and Biden factors, what they think. But that's one thing. But when it comes to will they share a dorm room if they voted opposite? No, they really don't want to.
Yeah, and it should be noted, Bob and I both went to college in Ohio. Bob was graduating just as I got out to school in Dayton, and so I missed the 76 election.
Yeah.
To be in the
dorms. You were a youngin.
Right, and yeah, and then by 1980, you know, we were in apartments where you already kind of selected your apartment mates, and I don't know that politics ever, you know, was an issue with me and any roommates back then. Nor people I dated, but, you know, who knows. All right. Hey, I want to throw something by you that was spotted in Burlington the other day. A friend and their family in town, and there they see Bernie Sanders walking down Church Street in Burlington. They snap a picture. With him is Bill de Blasio. First of all, Bernie we never see him this relaxed in a golf shirt and a baseball cap, but with de Blasio, former New York City mayor, and both of them were candidates in 2020 for the presidency. But you politicos, you know, that's a guy from the Senate, a New York City mayor, not necessarily moving in the same political circles generally, other than, you know, having campaigned against each other. But do you guys just all hang out, go out for an ice cream cone? And or what do you make of these two being together here in, you know, 2022 in Burlington?
Well, Mayor de Blasio did endorse Bernie Sanders for president, you know.
Yeah.
He did it in, I think, February of 2020 or so, he did it. So I think they probably remain cordial. In the old days, in the good old days, you know, we did talk with each other.
Yeah.
Bernie Sanders has been in my office a couple of times, and I did press conferences with Bernie Sanders. People, you know, would go to dinner in D.C., with each other and actually talk to each other, people of the opposite party. I think a lot of that's by the wayside. So I would assume, I don't think there's a lot of politics with, because de Blasio doesn't have a political future, frankly.
Yeah.
You know.
Yeah, I think you're right.
And so I think it's probably, maybe somebody made a phone call, maybe de Blasio called Bernie, said, how are you doing? And maybe de Blasio said, I'd love to get out of New York and walk those beautiful streets in Burlington and enjoy some of that weather.
Exactly.
I'm imagining that's the scenario.
All
I don't
right.
think there's any plots of, of a Sanders de Blasio ticket.
All right. I was wondering what your take would that be. All right. National correspondent Bob Ney. Don't forget the Ney-Singeri ticket coming up in 2024. Thanks for your insightful perspective,
Thank you,
Bob. All right.
See you.
We're going to take a break and then return to talk with Derek Brower of 7 Days about concerns legal cannabis growers are facing. This is Vermont Viewpoint on WDEV. We're back on Vermont Viewpoint. The time for legal pot sales is getting closer and closer, and it's high time. But will there be any legal weed on the shelves of cannabis outlets around the state? Derek Brower looked into it this week's 7 Days, and he joins us now to talk about it. Derek, welcome back to Vermont Viewpoint.
Yeah, it's great to be here.
Derek, when exactly will legal cannabis stores begin to open in Vermont?
Well, theoretically, they can on October 1st, but it's unclear how many will be open, you know, on day one, and how quickly the rest will come online. It's likely to be, I think, a more staggered rollout than a big statewide ribbon cutting.
I love the use of the word theoretically. Well done. Do we have an idea of how many will open this year, a general idea, and how many total should be opened around the state?
Yeah, in terms of the retail side, I mean, the Cannabis Control Board just a few weeks ago opened their call for applications for retailers. So those are still starting to stream in. I don't think there's any. I mean, there's certainly been interest in it so far, but we don't really have a clear picture yet exactly just how many shops are going to be around the state. One thing to remember too is that in Vermont, towns had to opt in to retail sales. Right. So not every town in the state can even have a shop.
That's right. Where will they be getting the pot that they'll be selling?
Yeah, well, that's the big question because this rollout is really being done on a more compressed timeline than anybody who is involved in it would like, and that stems from the way the legislature had initially set this up, as well as some other things. But there's been, over the course of the spring, summer, and now into late summer here, a rush amongst growers, both indoor and outdoor, and people doing both, to try to get licensed in time to be able to get their plants in the ground and harvest them and dry them and do the curing in time for that launch. But that's where we're really seeing some of the delays and snags along the way.
And how do these grow operations differ, you know, between those growing outdoors, those growing indoors?
Yeah, so you know, indoor growers, it's more expensive, it's more energy intensive as well, but there are real advantages to it. You can have you know, many harvests over the course of a year. But in Vermont, there are a number of people, particularly people who had been growing either for personal use or illegally for years, who've been growing in the sun, and they just get one shot and during the summer grow season. And so there has been a real pressure for these growers, many of whom don't have much money, are truly just independent, trying to be small business owners here, to try to get them licensed up so they could get their plants in the ground in time to harvest them this year, or else the fear amongst them, and it's becoming a reality for some, is that they're going to miss out on this first year of legal recreational weed entirely.
And I would imagine the indoor growers have a little bit better handle on security of their operation than those growing outdoors. Derek, what was the goal or initiative to have a certain amount of weed to come from local small-scale growers in Vermont?
Yeah, that's right. Actually, a portion of retailers have to source a portion of their product from small independent growers. So this has been really baked into the state's legalization framework. Is this emphasis that the market here should not be the province solely of large, well financed or corporate operators? That there needs to be a role. A strong role here for small business people and people who have experience with cannabis in the past. So that is you know, but bringing those folks into the legal market, convincing them that this is something that's in their best interest and that they should want to participate in, and then making it actually accessible to them. That's where it's been challenging so far.
Mm. And you mentioned these outdoor growers have just one growing season, one shot at this. For those growing outdoors, what would that growing season look like normally? When would they get things, plants in the ground and be able to harvest?
Yeah, I mean, can vary a little bit, but generally what I heard was that, that everybody wanted to have their plants in the ground before July, before the beginning of July. To be able to have time to get the full harvest, with the least amount of risk with weather on the back end of the season, and then to have enough time to process, before you're wholesaling it or whatever you're doing with it at that point. But the rub has been that, by the beginning of July, there were not very many, of these, applicants who had, gotten their license yet from the state's new cannabis control board, which meant that they could not legally, put their plants in the ground, yet. So what you've had is a lot of anxious, outdoor growers who have been, waiting to get their license squared away so that they could plant in time.
So how many, I don't know if you have a number or a percentage of the outdoor growers who have faced this roadblock, haven't got their licenses in time to get the plants in the ground outdoors?
Yeah, well, there are still, there are still at least 40 plus applicants for outdoor growers who have not gotten their license even today. Some of those have now withdrawn their licenses, and there's a variety of reasons why they haven't gotten their licenses yet, but there are several dozen who still don't have it. And there are even more who got their license, but got it too late to have a full harvest. But the caveat here is that a lot of these growers, as I've learned, they were expecting to get licensed, and so they put their plants in the ground or bought seedlings before they had their license in hand, expecting or not realizing that the quite how involved the process might be for them. And that's where some people are really anxious right now, because it's illegal to do that. They were cutting a corner basically, and now as the gap between planting and waiting for their license has gone on, they are in some legal jeopardy.
Mm. What reasons, Derek, have you heard for the delays in issuing these licenses?
Yeah, there's certainly amongst growers and producers, there is frustration directed toward the Cannabis Control Board. That's that is the regulatory body that was created through the legislature and then appointed. The board was appointed, but the problems go beyond the board as well. I think, particularly with this dilemma for outdoor growers, the board couldn't start accepting applications until April and May, which when you're trying to when you need to get your license by the end of June, that's a 2 to 3 month window to license what turned out to be more than 130 applicants for outdoor growing. Mm. And so part of the issue is that, that 130 number is just more than the state had expected. They had commissioned a study to see, how many growers do you think are going to want to do outdoor versus indoor in the state? And this consultant was told the state that they thought it would be more than three quarters indoor grow. And in fact, so far, it's actually been slightly majority outdoor grow. So the state was sort of a little surprised by this, and I think was caught unprepared to handle so many time-sensitive applications.
Have there been any complications from the federal government on getting this all done on time?
Yeah, that's a good point, too. One of the additional wrinkles in this was that the state had banked on doing background checks for these applicants through the FBI's system, and the FBI came back rather late, right on the eve of license applications sort of coming in, that and said that they were not willing to participate in this. I guess they said this to a number of states that were trying to do this with them, but that left the Cannabis Control Board scrambling in the spring to figure out how they could come up with a different way of doing reliable background checks. So they ended up finding a private vendor But they're basically, the way I'm thinking of it is they're sort of doing it manually, state by state. And so it takes longer than the FBI checks would. It's also more expensive. It costs almost $500 per business partner just for the background check, which may not sound like a lot for as a business expense, but a lot of these growers, remember, are individual residents who maybe are growing on their own land and do not necessarily have a lot of money to front for their new business.
We've got about 30 seconds left, Derek. We are not the first state to do this. In fact, I think we could just head over, to a neighboring state, Massachusetts, that got up and running. Why has Vermont fallen behind when we didn't have to reinvent the wheel?
Yeah, I mean, that's a great question. I mean, I think that's fueling some of the frustration, too. We are not by no means the first state to attempt this. I think Vermont, though, has tried to do it a little bit differently. I think what I heard from the chair of the Cannabis Control Board, he pointed out that if we did this like some of those other states where basically you're just giving new licenses to corporate-owned medical dispensaries, it would be easier to do. But Vermont is decided they want to do it a Vermont way, and to invite small growers into the scene, and that has proven to be a more complicated endeavor than I think the legislature had bargained.
All right, fair point. You can read Derek Brower's story in this week's issue of 7 Days or at 7daysvt.com. Derek, thanks so much for joining us.
Yeah, appreciate it.
Okay. We're going to take a break for news and then return to discuss cybersecurity. And tonight, the Red Sox open up a series in Baltimore. Our coverage begins at 6:05. First pitch at 7:05. This is Vermont Viewpoint on WDEV.
In decades past, you opened a business, hung out your shingle, and the customers came. Today, hanging out your shingle means creating an engaging website. The modern consumer is using the internet to find businesses like yours. Are you positioned so you'll rise to the top of their search? Let the Radio Vermont Group Digital Services work with you to make sure you're visible online and to target your marketing to location, demographic, and interest. Learn more at rvgdigital.com.
Welcome back to Vermont Viewpoint. I'm Rick Singeri. When I was in college, I earned some credit hours by managing a Burger King and handling some of its marketing outreach. I did get some free Whoppers. Our next guest could probably protect the entire Burger King chain from cyber attack at the college internship that he's been working at. But does he get fries with that? Joining me now is Parker Soares, a computer networking and cybersecurity major at Champlain College Class of 2024. Tell us about his internship. Parker, welcome to Vermont Viewpoint.
Hi, Rick. How are you doing?
I'm great. Listeners, to ask our guest about what he's studying and putting into practice, you can call us at 802-244-1777 or 877-291-TALK. Parker, we're getting a lot of feedback. My voice echoing there. Is there a speakerphone you have on that we might be able to turn off?
Does this sound better?
That probably does it. Thank you, Parker. You can also email vtviewpoint at radiovermont.com. Parker, what originally spurred your interest in cybersecurity?
Well, when I was looking for schools, I actually started looking in the engineering field and the architecture field. And it was actually my mother who pointed me towards Champlain College, given their cybersecurity program. And being a local, I actually didn't know much about the school initially. So I actually chose the school and then landed on the degree program as a result.
Where are you from originally, Parker?
I was born in Burlington, and I currently live in Williston, Vermont.
Oh, so very local to Champlain College. And your mom suggested cybersecurity at Champlain College. What is it about cybersecurity that really attracted you to the program?
Well, when I was younger, I was in Boy Scouts, and helping other people was always a really big part of that. And that's kind of followed me through the years, and that's a big driving factor for me in my decision towards cybersecurity, since it really is, in my eyes, it's a huge public service.
How high in the Boy Scouts did you climb? To what rank?
Actually, I made it to Eagle Scout back in high school.
Wow. Congratulations. I had to drop out at second class, so please don't make fun of me. But as an Eagle Scout, you probably had to do some type of project. So what did you do?
Yeah, I actually built some bridge and puncheon work here in Williston for some local trails.
That's outstanding. Now, for the uninitiated, before we venture too far, Parker, explain exactly what cybersecurity is.
Yeah, so cybersecurity is focused on protecting users and their devices from any sort of cyber-related threats. So anyone who is wishing to do you or your system harm, and we'd like to focus on three elements, and that's the confidentiality, integrity, and availability of a system. So this goes for businesses, and it also goes for private individuals as well.
And what type of things are you protecting against? You know, individually, give us like an example, and for a corporation.
Sure. So on a higher level, we're obviously focusing on protecting data. So a good example on the private level is if you have bank account information or personally identifiable information, social security number, any of that kind of information stored on a local device, you want to keep that safe. And then looking on a more commercial level, for example, hospitals and banking institutions, they also have customer information stored on their systems, and they may also have confidential business information. So if you work for a company that has perhaps information that a competitor does not, and they want to keep that information, you know, close to the vest, that's the kind of data that we're trying to keep safe from people who may benefit from stealing it or destroying it.
Now, these nefarious characters are out there cooking up a lot of new ways to attack both individuals and companies and try to get to that data. How do you create programs that protect, you know, our various programs and databases?
Well, it's a big combination of things. As people who are looking to defend networks from attackers, there are a lot of tools out there that have been made to help us with that defensive approach. But one of the issues that we face as a larger community is that technology is always evolving and there's always something that's changing. So even though we have some tools that may help us detect existing threats, new threats are appearing every day. So people like myself, we have to do a lot of research and figure out what new ways attackers are trying to compromise systems. So we need to really take into account a bunch of moving parts. And normally most of the work we're doing is finding anything that looks suspicious on a computer and then tracing it back to the source.
Parker, you had an amazingly interesting internship this summer. Tell us about the company you worked with, first of all.
Yeah, so Comcode is based out of Grobenzell, Germany, and that is near Munich, for those who don't know. I actually ended up working remotely, so I was here in Burlington throughout the course of the summer. But typically what they actually do is they take a handful of Champlain College students and they end up working out in Germany with either Comcode directly or a partner company in the area. So Comcode has this Munich cybersecurity program, and they've been doing this with Champlain for a few years now. And I actually had the opportunity to work directly with Comcode and the CEO, Marcus Geyer, researching automotive cybersecurity.
How big is Comcode? How big a company is it?
Comcode itself is actually relatively small. Last I checked, they actually only have probably a dozen, maybe a couple dozen employees, but they work with relatively large companies. And this is kind of a common denominator in the cybersecurity field, is that there's a lot of things to cover and not a whole lot of hands to do it. So like many, they are a small company working with large clients.
And Parker, sprechen Sie Deutsch? Do you understand any German? Was there any kind of language barrier between you here in Vermont and them over in Germany?
Well, I actually don't know any German, but luckily, Marcus is very fluent in English, and a lot of people from Germany actually know a fair amount of English, so that was very fortunate on my part to still be able to interact very easily with a lot of other members of the company who speak German as a primary language. So there were a few language barriers throughout my time, mostly with some of the technical wording, as that is not something that translates very clearly, but we worked very hard to try to get that figured out.
Well, you now know how to say, do you speak German? This internship, why was this an opportunity you were interested in, more, you know, working with COMCO than, say, an American-based company?
Yeah, I actually was very drawn to this internship primarily because I was interested in going to Germany and seeing another culture. As you can see, it didn't end up working out that way this year, but I was equally interested in learning more about automobiles in particular. So finding the automotive cybersecurity path was of great interest to me.
Mm. How long was the internship?
So this covered the whole summer for me. So I started a couple weeks after I got out of school. So this would have been late May, and it actually just ended last week. Mm. So it was about 3 months.
And then when do classes start again at Champlain College? You're pretty close, I think.
Yeah, I'm about a week away. They start on the 29th.
You ready?
Yeah, I'm feeling excited for this semester.
Okay, good. Now, you mentioned Marcus Geyer, the CEO of COMCODE. He has set up this connection with Champlain College, and you worked very closely with him. Was it intimidating being an intern working with the company's CEO?
That's one thing I've learned very quickly with Champlain is they are not very shy about introducing their students to people who work very high up in many different companies. So this is not the first time I have spoken to and worked with the CEO of a cybersecurity company, believe it or not. And initially it's always, you know, it's a little intimidating because they have a lot more experience and they have a lot of knowledge under their belt. And one thing I've always found is once you really take the time to get to know them, it's a very easy relationship to have just talking with them. And once you work with them on a day-to-day basis, you know, they're everyday people too.
Parker, what specifically were you working on during this internship?
So throughout the internship, there was a few phases involved. Overall, I spent a lot of time looking at regulations and the attack surface that is on a vehicle. So I took the time to really dig into how a vehicle is vulnerable and the different ways that people have been attacking them. And I looked back to about 2010 and dug through numerous news articles on the many different ways that this has happened and the ways that it continues to happen.
So our own cars can be cyber attacked is what you're saying?
Certainly.
Hmm. What did you learn from this internship?
For me, I was really oblivious to just how vulnerable a lot of vehicles are. And I think a lot of us would be very surprised to hear about the many different ways that vehicles can be broken into, for sure. One of the big things is that there are key fobs that we have that transmit signals to our vehicles, and it is very easy to copy that signal on a lot of vehicles and be able to unlock the car, even if you don't actually have the key fob in hand. And so these are the kind of things that I was reading about that I didn't even know actually existed prior to this summer.
Oh, my goodness. And do all the students from Champlain who intern with COMCODE focus on the automotive cybersecurity? Are there other fields, other businesses that they've been working with?
So COMCODE and the Munich Cybersecurity Program, they focus on a very wide variety of topics, and a lot of the content is actually based off of what the needs of their partner companies are and what the interests of the student are. So I had some coworkers this summer who were also working remotely with me here in Burlington, and they were focused on digital forensics, and they were also testing some defensive products that have been on the market for a few years. And these are only a few of the projects that have happened. So it actually it looks very different for most of the people who go through the program. And automotive cybersecurity was a topic that I focused on, and a few of the students in previous years have also looked at as well.
How is ComCode and the automotive industry working to address those threats that you mentioned?
So ComCode itself is a consultancy, and they work with medium and large companies to address cyber attacks before and after the fact. So they do incident response or damage control after an event happens to help a company rebuild, but they also provide services to help mitigate those threats before they happen. So they use most of their resources to conduct research and assist companies in securing the network, whether that's pointing them towards other companies that have the tools they need to protect their networks, or if that means helping them find the resources to recover data, whether they were hit with a ransomware attack or if their network got shut down without their knowledge.
Do you think that you'd like to work in the automotive industry after you graduate?
Yeah, one thing that this internship really showed me is that there is a blend of interests for me, both in the automotive industry and in cybersecurity. So this is a path that I would definitely like to move down moving forward.
In addition to this internship, Parker, how has your time at Champlain College prepared you to work for a cybersecurity company going forward upon graduation?
Well, Champlain has given me numerous opportunities over just the past 2 years. Right from the beginning, I was working through the Leahy Center, which is connected to Champlain College, and I was interning, working on a security operations center. So I was given a ton of experience right from the beginning, and I've had a lot of different opportunities in the form of internships and scholarships moving through my time here at Champlain, and I still have 2 more years to go. So they've really exposed me to the cybersecurity market and a lot of businesses already just as a rising junior. So they've increased my understanding of the industry. So it hasn't just been, getting required classes taken care of. They really focus on preparing me and other students for the industry that we're trying to get into.
And looking at it the other way, how do you think what you've learned at ComCode will help you in these last 2 years of school at Champlain?
I think it really gave me a practical sense of what it's like to work for a business full time. That's something that I haven't done, at least in my field, in the same way. So having that full work week focusing on content that's relevant to me, I think getting that organizational mindset and working with peers to solve a lot of the cybersecurity related problems, as well as, like we mentioned earlier, interacting with leadership in the company. It's not something that you get in the classroom. So this internship really helped with that.
Man, oh man, I wish I had your perspective when I was going into my junior year of college. What kind of, I know you didn't get to go to Germany, but you worked with, a German firm. So what kind of global perspective do you think you gained by doing this internship?
Well, a lot of the research I was doing, I really had to broaden my perspective of what I was looking at. So I wasn't just looking at, say, the American automobile market. I had to look on a global scale at cyber attacks that are happening internationally and companies that are working internationally in order to really understand the clientele that Germany is working with. And this is really true for most people who are in cybersecurity, that technology isn't limited to national borders, and we really have to be aware of the global market and not just the smaller, the United States, for example. It's kind of the global approach is really an important aspect to consider if you're going to work in technology and cybersecurity especially.
You have another summer at the end of your spring semester for one more internship before graduation in spring of 2024. And I don't know if this is possible, but have you considered next summer joining ComCode again in an internship?
So Marcus has talked with me already about extending and continuing my work with him, and I actually plan on working with him this fall as a part-time position as opposed to a contracted internship. So I will continue working with him this coming fall to further the project. And he did also extend me the offer to continue working with him the following summer, but I do already have another job commitment the coming summer. So.
Oh, my goodness. Well, that's certainly gratifying to have this part-time job while you're starting your junior year. How does it feel to go back to school and say, oh, I'm still going to be working for Comcode?
I mean, it's been a great experience this summer working with Marcus in particular and having the opportunity to continue that work, especially while I'm continuing my studies, is something I'm very grateful for. I think continuing to get the relevant work experience with a cybersecurity company alongside my studies is something that is incredibly valuable and not something that I wanted to pass up, to say the least.
Yeah, no doubt. Parker Soares is a computer networking and cybersecurity major at Champlain College, class of 2024. You can learn more about those programs at champlain.edu. Parker, I want to thank you for being on the show, and best of luck with your career.
Thank you. It was good talking to you.
Good talking to you. That is our show for today. Vermont Viewpoint is directed by Danny McGivergan. Our email address is vtviewpoint@radiovermont.com. Feel free to suggest guests or topics, and you can listen to past episodes of Vermont Viewpoint by downloading our podcast at wdevradio.com. You can also subscribe to the podcast there. Common Sense Radio with Bill Sayre is up next. I'm Rick Singeri. I'll meet you back here on Monday when we talk about drop-in brewing in Middlebury and with new Burlington Free Press editor Aki Soga.